Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Behind the Human. I'm your host, Mark Champagne, and it's my job to unpack the stories and mental fitness practices of people living at the top of their game, personally and professionally. And today I'm super pumped because we've got a return guest on the show. We've got Jeff, who is the CEO and co-founder at Commune, an online course platform featuring world-renowned teachers in integrative medicine, personal development, yoga, meditation, and social impact. Jeff is also the host of the Commune podcast, which ranks in the top 1% of all pods, which is no small feat. So it's beautiful to have you back, Jeff. Welcome to the show.
Oh, Mark, what a treat. I've been looking forward to this and reconnecting with you and your audience.
Yeah, me too. I mean, we recorded the first episode, of course, which it's been over 2 years, and I pulled it up here as I was preparing for this conversation. So for new listeners or ones that want to revisit that episode, it's called Presence, Love, and Stoicism with Jeff Krasno. So you can imagine we went pretty deep on Stoicism, which I feel, given it was around the same time that Personal Socrates launched, you and I were really geeking out about the power of questions and introspection.
That's right.
So I can't wait to see where this one goes, because I imagine a lot of that introspection led to kind of this latest round of work. But before we go there, as you know, first question everyone gets, job titles aside, work aside, as we speak right now, who are you?
Yeah, who am I? I've come to believe that I really am no one. and by that, the more I've learned about human physiology over the last 4 or 5 years, interviewing 400 plus doctors, the more that the metaphysical is reflected in the physical. And a lot of these teachings that were intuitive in nature some 2,500 years ago, such that, like, we are process, we are impermanent, we are changing incessantly in relation to our environment. These things, you know, then became proved out in quantum physics, and now in kind of more functional and integrative medicine seems to point to that same phenomenon, that we are just simply process evolving in relation to our exposome or our environment. So I very much have become to see myself that way. And it's a little scary, you know, because, you know, Mark, so much of the time we're sort of anchored to our identity through a sense of physical and psychological continuity. Like, I wake up, I look in the mirror, like, I suck in my gut, flex my pecs, whatever. It's like, there's Jeff. He looks more or less the same as he did yesterday. And that same is true for my psychology. Like, oh, I wake up, you know, I still don't like the Lakers, you know, whatever. And we're anchored to that, that continuity, but really, you know, all we need to do is actually, like, open a photo album to know that, you know, there's Mark as a little baby, and there's him as a strapping adolescent. And here he is, you know, a distinguished member of middle age almost. And that, you know, we are in constant evolution. We are process. So it's actually very, and in a way it's scary, and then in a way it's very empowering, because if we are changing moment to moment in relation to our environment, we can be on a trajectory towards healing, towards wholeness, I should say, and stepping into the best version of ourselves day in and day out. You know, or we can be on that opposite trajectory towards ailing and disease. I'm really not anyone at all.
I'd love it. Do you want to know how you answered it last time?
Sure. Yeah.
I'm always, you know, there's a handful of return guests and a few that have done three rounds now. And it's always interesting to see how this answer evolves and so forth. And essentially, I mean, you had a longer answer than this, but the gist of it was, I'm in an expansive and dynamic time in my life, which was interesting. It's probably about 2.5 years ago. Does that ring true at all to you right now?
Sure. I would say, you know, dynamic points to, you know, motion towards change and impermanence. And I feel like I'm on that same trajectory, honestly. You know, I'm so fortunate enough to be able to pursue my curiosity day to day. And, you know, like you, I do host a podcast, and that, you know, if only for my own vanity, I'm reading and researching just to not embarrass myself publicly. But through that, you know, I'm in a constant state of learning and growing. And talking to people, you know, 10x smarter than I am, you know, day to day. And that, you know, keeps one in a state of expansion and curiosity. That said, I'm also trying to find more repair and restoration in my life. I don't want to be growing all the time. and there are times for fallow and for silence and for quiet and interoception. And I think those things come a little bit harder to me instinctively. So, you know, trying to balance, you know, growth and these kind of periods of repair and quiet in my life.
That is, I've been thinking a lot about that topic myself, because, you know, we obviously have some similarities in the work that we do, or at least the people we study and are able to interact with. And I've kind of felt, and it's happening as we speak in a way of, I'm very grateful, of course, with, you know, the guests who come on. And as you said, you get to learn and you're always expanding your mind, but that also comes with, it almost feels like a pressure to just always be growing and evolving. And I wonder for others who are not always surrounded by this kind of work that we're in, that this kind of our job, that, like, how do we balance that, right? Like, is it seasons of okay, we're, you know, I'm going to focus here and evolve and so forth, and maybe pick a topic that is relevant in my life and go deep and so forth. But then, to your point, I think we need to intentionally also kind of schedule in the next season of, oh, I'm just going to flow and let, you know, what needs to come up or whatever that is. I don't know what the label is to that, but how have you, over the last, you know, few years or so, how have you thought about this? Or have you been able to kind of come up with a solution for yourself to balance?
No, but I'm trying. I mean, so, you know, I didn't go to medical school, Mark, but over the last 3 or 4 years, I've essentially autodidactically tried to put myself through one.
Sure.
And, you know, as I became more interested in human physiology and particularly metabolism, as I stared my own diabetes in the face, you know, I started learning and reading, and, you know, obviously books on medical science, but also primary source data. And, you know, there I'd be there like 10:30 at night reading PubMed and trying to get primary source data under my skin. And, you know, I wouldn't understand, you know, 75% of the words, really. And my wife was like, what are you doing? Go to bed. And then, you know, slowly I, you know, began to understand 50% of the words, and then, you know, most of the words. And you grow. But what happens is, you know, when you bring a torch out into the night sky, you know, what you realize is how much blackness actually exists. And so, you know, as I began to learn more, the more I realized I didn't know. And, like, for example, then I got like obsessed with, like, oh, well, I'm going to learn the 10 stages of a glycolysis as part of, you know, cellular respiration, energy production. And I'm like,
just a normal thing to do on a Saturday night.
Pretty much. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm 52 or whatever, 51 when I started doing that. And I was like, I started to question, is this the best use of my time? But, you know, I think, you know, what we do know, just as product of our own direct experience, whether we remember this or not day to day, is that, you know, wisdom often does come in the spaces, you know, when we, you know, take that long hike, or we're kind of in a regular quiet or meditation or contemplation practice, you know, these moments of satori or realization often appear unforced. And of course, those are great reminders that, you know, we need to create that kind of space in our lives, and that there is a flip side to cognition. You know, I love learning and I love reason and I'm a fan of the Enlightenment, et cetera. But there is something also to be said for direct experience. And, you know, opening yourself up to mystical experiences, you know, such that like you start to lose the feeling of what it's like to be you as a separate individuated self, and you feel more yoked with the fabric of the universe. That is truly a mystical experience, that kind of transformation from the feeling of a separate self to integrated consciousness. And that really only happens outside of cognition, kind of outside of the mind, if you will. And so you have to create openness there to have those direct experiences. And I think that's a challenge for folks like us who are very curious, whose natural inclination is just to like go and continue to keep learning.
Yeah. You mentioned diabetes, which, you know, as I hear you speak about that, how you know, the response you just gave around your curiosity and learning and so forth. And then of course, just being surrounded and having interviewed so many, you know, experts in health and longevity and so forth. When you found out that you had diabetes, where did that land for you? How did you feel?
In the health space, we tend to assign labels to clusters of symptoms such that then we can treat those symptoms generally with pharmaceutical drugs, but with other protocols as well.
Yeah.
And so having the label of diabetes in some ways like did bring it home, but it didn't really change my direct experience of life. So, you know, going into it, you know, for years, you know, I ran this company called Wanderlust. It was a wonderful experience in my life. And I think it created many ripples of positivity for many people. But for me, it nearly killed me, you know, physiologically. For years, I was just traveling. I had wicked insomnia, brain fog, chronic fatigue, just general irritability. Like I couldn't read a book. I just didn't even have that level of concentration. I was always picking up my phone every 2 seconds. And, you know, what all of those symptoms or presentations that I just described, they're so boring, right? They're just so common and prosaic.
Yeah.
And probably half your listeners are like, oh yeah, that's just me, you know? And they're so ordinary in modern life that we've normalized them.
Yeah, but that's the scary part.
Yeah, but they're not normal at all. In fact, these clusters of symptoms, which ladder up to metabolic dysfunction generally, I mean, that was as normal as like Stoneman syndrome or something, you know, 200 years ago, I think the world's most rare disease or something. Nobody experienced that. Mm-hmm. And so, but now it's so easy to write those symptoms off of as just like, oh, I'm just having a bad day. Oh, I'm under a little bit of stress. Oh, I didn't get enough sleep last night, et cetera. And then, you know, then when you put a label on top of that called diabetes, well, then, you know, it is a wake up call. And it was a wake up call for me. I mean, there were other presentations that were that insult to my vanity. I mean, I was like, you know, I was like 210 pounds. Like I started to grow these like weird little gross, this is like TMI, I suppose, but like brown, like skin tags in my armpits. And you might sometimes see those on the back of people's necks and something. You know, those are, as I found out, like indications of insulin resistance or prediabetes. And then, you know, I often joke, I had these, what clinically is known as gynecomastia, but as you might know, is boobs of man. And my children wasted not a single opportunity to remind me that they weren't A cups. And, you know, whatever. So I didn't like the way I looked. But then, you know, when you have a specific diagnosis, you know, it does open your eyes. So I started wearing, like, for the people watching on video, like a little disc on the back of my triceps here. It's a continuous glucose monitor. And
so informative.
Yeah.
I encourage essentially everyone to at least do a month with continuous glucose monitor just to blow open your mind of what's happening.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. You know, they are, unless you're a diabetic, ridiculously, your doctor generally can't prescribe them. It might be different in Canada, but so you have to come out of pocket for them. But here's the deal. It's like, I often make the metaphor, the analogy with a dashboard in a car. I mean, you would never drive the car if the dashboard didn't light up, right? And then, if, you know, the tire pressure light or the check engine light would go on. I mean, if you were me, you'd probably blow it off for a day or two, but eventually, you know, you'd deal with it and address it. And it's, you know, this particular human vehicle that we have, that we have one lease on, that's it. You know, we don't really have much of a dashboard generally. We've for hundreds of years, or at least 100 years, you know, relied on this annual visit to our primary care physician. And sometimes we cancel it. Sometimes we go, we get basic blood labs, generally never hear about it, and we just move on. And we just assume that everything in our vehicle is tip-top shape. But, you know, what really this is, this continuous glucose monitor or this Oura Ring or some, you know, Whoop, people wear Whoops and Apple Watches and other devices, they are dashboards into your own physiology, such that then you can become the CEO of your own healthcare, or at least an informed agent over the nature of your physiology. And the continuous glucose monitor gives you, you know, data moment to moment of your blood glucose levels. So it syncs with an app, and you can go in and look at that data and garner a lot of information there. I mean, you know, I started to understand the behaviors from sleep to exercise to food to sauna that would spike my glucose levels. And try to understand why, and then try to bring my fasting glucose level down into an optimal range. And that was huge for me, because not only was it a nice number to look at, it had all of these knock-on impacts in how I feel and how I felt about life. And that was a game changer for me.
So, Val, I don't think I shared this with you when we had our interview, but I was pre-diabetic, I guess 4 or 5 years ago, and just completely rocked my, I mean, I heard that label, and my father, he was full on diabetic, and kind of like the standard North American image of, I was about to say health, but the normalized version of health, which is, I would say, to use Mark Hyman's, some of his language I've heard recently, you know, that 93% of Americans are metabolically unfit. That was kind of my dad as well. So I had this view of, wow, I can see where this track's going, but I didn't look like my dad, you know, I felt pretty healthy. Mind you, I had been on these protein pump inhibitors for a decade, which was bothering me, heartburn medications for those wondering. And I started working with an integrative medicine team. I was doing work with them on the mental fitness side, and we've got to get you off these heartburn meds. Like, that's not good for you. And then, you know, obviously we're going to get, you know, you linked up with a continuous glucose monitor. And that's why I said it just blew my mind, because for me, it was not necessarily, you know, really unhealthy eating, but just kind of the order of how I was eating, and to what you mentioned as well, just being like observing how different events or things that I was doing, like how that was reacting in my body. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, I put one on every now and then just to kind of get a pulse to see what's going on, and almost just as a reminder in case I come off into, you know, habits that aren't serving me, but just completely changed the way I eat in the order of things. And I haven't taken one of those heartburn, I don't even own them for, I mean, there were other, you know, I went through a whole protocol and whatnot, but I haven't taken one of those pills in 3 years.
Yeah.
And no symptoms.
I was on the same trip, you know, I was, you know, PPIs and NSAIDs and,
yeah,
you know, all these microbiome disruptors. And then you wonder why you have inflammation, which is then contributing, you know, to your insulin resistance and prediabetes. And, you know, that, you know, I didn't know that about you, Mark. And that's interesting that we share that story. But we're, again, our stories are actually quite, they're only extraordinary because they're so ordinary.
Yeah.
You know, 50% of the people in the United States are pre-diabetic or diabetic. And 90% of the pre-diabetics don't know it. They're undiagnosed.
Yeah.
And largely because until you hit that diabetes zone, you know, with your fasting glucose or fasting insulin or hemoglobin A1C, your doctor's not really going to prescribe or deal with it. You know, they're just going to wait till you're diabetic and then give you metformin or now, you know, Ozempic or, you know, Wegovy or something. So, you know, so again, you know, this is where we do have like tremendous agency. And, you know, just to watch your blood glucose levels vacillate moment to moment, it does speak to how we kicked off the conversation, is that, you know, what is happening in this organism is just unbelievable. It's 37 billion billion chemical reactions per second. There is literally nothing stable and reliable about what it is to be me. And you can ask my wife to corroborate. But just on a physiological basis, you know, the liver is like titrating just like perfectly to release just the right amount of glucose so your cells can uptake it for the production of energy. And then that's getting converted into ATP, and the ATP is getting burned. And like all of this stuff is happening. Your microbiome is turning over, you know, every couple of days, and each bacteria lasts maybe 4 minutes or 4 hours. You know, all of this process is constantly changing. And when you actually can see it change on your phone, you realize that, okay, I do have some agency over this process. And now what am I going to do?
Great, great segue. Because I wanted to get into that, obviously. But I have to say, because I always think about, especially when we're speaking about health, and I love your analogy of dashboards, I always think of the business world, right? And we're in it as well. Like if you looked at a business scorecard of some sort and replaced those numbers with some of our health scores, I mean, the business would be out of control. Like it would be like, this looks like the
federal government.
Exactly. Right. Totally. That's a good point. But in, let's just say private business, or in other situations, I mean, those alarm bells would be sounding loud and clear. It's like, we've got to do something here, but for whatever reason, we're making good strides. I think we're coming along. We don't look at our health, from that perspective. So I love that, you know, you're kind of approaching this from agency.
Yeah.
We do have agency.
I've thought about it by analogy with finances before, because really the key to health in all of its expressions is balance, equilibrium in the body. It's called homeostasis. And we seek that balance all the time. We seek to essentially like balance our budgets, right? You know, balance our bank account, balance our checking account, right? I mean, it's often in vain and not successfully. But, you know, really when you begin to study what is the nature of well-being? And you start to look around you in economics, it's like, looks like a bell curve. It's like the, you know, distribution of wealth across the middle class. And ecology, it's generally characterized by biodiversity, like a clustering towards the middle. In politics, you could look at it, it's the absence of extremes, right? It's actually common ground and cooperation and finding middle ground such that we can actually make progress in society. So almost everywhere you look, you know, health is a reflection of balance. And that is 100% true in the human body. Everywhere you look, you know, basically every pathway and molecule has its counterposing pathway and molecule, you know, from mTOR and AMPK, from insulin and glucagon, from excitatory neurotransmitters and inhibitory neurotransmitters. Everything the body is unbelievably engineered to actually foster homeostasis until we fuck it up. With culture generally, with the way that we live, and we create these evolutionary mismatches where culture, essentially the way we live, upends our engineering, our biology, and then it is up to us to realign the way we live with this miracle of evolution that is your body.
Well, let's talk about I guess putting a pause on sabotaging this beautiful body of ours and some things that we can actually do, which I think dovetails into what you did, you know, to reverse your diabetes. And maybe I pulled a quote from you that I really, really enjoyed. Maybe we can just kind of kick off from there. And you said, it's not chronic disease that's killing us. It's chronic ease. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So chronic disease, generally characterized by the labels heart disease, stroke, diabetes, dementia, Alzheimer's, other neurodegenerative diseases, fatty liver disease, they're like the most prevalent chronic diseases. These did not exist. And let me add cancer, because cancer did exist barely. But yeah, all of those other diseases that I just named didn't really exist, 200 years ago, but certainly, you know, 10,000 or 12,000 years ago when we were kind of roaming the Serengeti as hunter-gatherers. And I'm not an evolutionary biologist, but these diseases didn't even exist really in great amounts, even 50 years ago. So our genome hasn't changed. You know, our underlying genetics remains the same. So what can you point to that would explain the efflorescence, the cresting waves of these diseases? Well, it's culture. It's the way we live. So what has changed? Well, over the last 100 years or 150 years, we've essentially at every turn engineered our culture and our lifestyle for convenience, for comfort, for ease. Now, this isn't always pernicious or malicious. You know, we were at the end of World War II, we were challenged, like, how are we going to feed billions and billions of people around the world, you know, with cheap, shelf-stable calories? So, you know, we started this food industrial complex, and we used it. We used our leftover ammonium nitrate, actually, from bombs, and poured it into our agricultural fields, and you know, we created a system of essentially like monoculture or, you know, modern industrial food, which, yeah, it did check the boxes on shelf stability, cheap, excess surfeit of calories, but obviously, you know, this is a very, very clear case of culture upending biology, because we were simply not evolved to eat refined sugars and starches and ultra-processed foods all day long, 24/7, 365 days a year. I mean, I went into a Denny's, Mark, like randomly couple of years ago, and I looked up at the sandwich board, and they're not just three meals a day anymore. There was like breakfast, thank God, served all day, lunch, yeah, dinner, and then there's late night. We have four meals a day. So we're just like eating these ultra-processed, refined foods that hijack our biology, and then we're eating them all day and nonstop. Mm-hmm. So if you really take a step back and you say, how did I evolve? Because this organism evolved in relation to its environment over hundreds of thousands of years as Homo sapiens, but like millions of years as hominids. And how did I evolve? Well, I evolved as an opportunistic omnivore. I ate a ton of plants, 800 different plants, seeds, tubers, etc. Some wild game when it was available. Woohoo! You know, yeah, lean protein, great. But I also endured periods of food scarcity. That was, yeah, just a customary part of life. And, you know, we are designed to be a little bit fat. Like being fat is actually adaptive when it's in the late summer and early fall. And we actually developed to do that because we knew that there would be a paucity of calories associated with winter's fallow. Winter was just around the corner. So we got a little fat. Our loincloth got a little tight in the fall, right? And not great for Instagram, but amazing, yeah, on the savannah. And then, but of course, fast forward now, there is no scarcity, right? So, yeah, so basically our adaptive mechanisms are like, Jeff, store fat, winter's coming, store fat. But then winter never comes. So what am I doing? I'm just storing fat all, mm-hmm, the time. And then you look around and there's a 45% obesity rate. Like, that's not a bug in the system. That's actually, yeah, the natural and expected outcome of this Paleolithic genome simply trying to cope with the way that we live. It's adaptive. And so this is what happens over and over again with all these artifacts of culture, is that what was adaptive has now become maladaptive. And there's so many examples of this. You know, we were literally engineered to move our bodies. We were engineered to walk 6 to 10 miles a day and lift heavy things. And that was like, there is no greater example of like short-term pain for long-term gain, or use stress, or hormesis, or what I call good stress, then lifting something heavy, overloading that muscle, ripping the fibers, the microfibers in that muscle, giving it a chance to rest, and then letting that thing repair. And guess what happens? It grows. It gets, yeah, stronger, you know? And so this is how we evolved. So this is where so much of my work has focused, is like when I ask myself, when I'm looking through, when I'm asking myself, what should I do to be healthy? I always look through this lens and ask this question: how did I evolve? And then, mm-hmm, I try to greater align the way that I live with my evolutionary engineering.
Love that question. And it makes sense when I look at, for those listening, I mean, I'll put this all in the show notes, but you develop a course around good stress and these 10 protocols, which I believe is what you use to reverse your diabetes and whatnot. But when I look at the top of the protocols, you know, a lot of it, to me, it comes back to your question of how did I evolve, and like, what are the basics? You know, am I sleeping? Am I hydrated? Am I moving? Am I eating? You kept mentioning food in the description of our current kind of, let's just call it, grocery system. It's not even food at this point. It's like food like substances, is I think the terminology I heard recently. I said that makes a lot of sense. So it's the basics, right? So how did you start, Jeff? Because it can almost feel overwhelming, because unfortunately, there are so many systems that are messed up at this point, and it's just, they've become these monsters on their own over time. It can be overwhelming, right?
Yeah.
Where do you suggest people to just start, or what questions to start asking?
Yeah. So I think the question, how did I evolve, is key.
Yeah.
And then also, it is easy to become paralyzed or even numb in the face of the magnitude of the problem, like you're pushing a massive boulder up a hill. But take a step back for a second. Start slow and start simple and just major in the majors. Okay. So yeah, I evolved with periods of food scarcity. Now I have to self-impose some degree of scarcity in a world that offers none. Okay, so what does that mean? So I adopted an intermittent fasting protocol or a time-restricted eating protocol to better align my lifestyle with my biology. So that means not stuffing my face 24 hours a day, or 20 of the 24 hours a day, or even 18 of the 24 hours. So I personally adopted a 16-8 protocol where I consolidated all of my consumption of food in 8 hours. And there's a lot of potential benefits associated with that. And yes, you are probably going to calorie restrict. You probably are going to lose weight. Of course, you can eat 16 pints of ice cream in an hour. So it's not, you don't, you're not necessarily going to, and I might have done that once, but, but here's the thing. It's like when you become a disciple to these practices, then there's this effect called Hawthorne effect, where behavior changes under observation, even when that observation is self-observation. So when you're making conscious, mindful choices, for example, about food, you are probably going to eat higher quality food. You are going to shop for higher quality food. You're going to cook more of your own meals. And you're probably going to lose weight. You're certainly going to upgrade your insulin sensitivity by condensing your eating window, because you're not going to be stressing your pancreas all day long to produce this hormone called insulin. Insulin resistance is what leads to diabetes. And here was a great satori that I want to share with you, Mark, about the nature of the human body. Every molecule in excess will create a resistance to itself. This is how we get ourselves out of balance. So we know this sometimes with coffee or even beer in my younger days. The more you have of it, the more you consume of it, the greater tolerance you have to it, right? So then you need more of it. This is also what happens with insulin in the body. So the more glucose or carbohydrates you're eating over large sections of the day, the more you're stressing your pancreas to produce more insulin. That insulin, your cells will eventually develop a resistance to that product, and your pancreas will require make more of it, and eventually you'll become insulin resistant, and that is what leads to essentially diabetes. So by condensing your eating window, you are going to make yourself, your cells, more insulin sensitive, such that they're going to uptake glucose for the production of energy instead of resisting it and storing it as fat. So this was key for me. It was intermittent fasting was kind of my first rung on the ladder.
Okay.
But then there's these other components to it. You know, from the production of BDNF and mitobiogenesis and all these other kinds of complicated issues that are cool things that happen. But all of that aside, I think the most potent impact of this practice is the following. Just because I condensed my eating window into 8 hours doesn't mean I didn't get hungry in the other parts of the day. At 9 p.m., I would get a pang of hunger, right? But I was committed to this practice. My discipleship was strong, right? So I couldn't just mindlessly wander over to the cupboard or the freezer and grab that chubby hubby the way I might have otherwise.
Yeah.
So what did that force me to do? That forced me to take a moment and examine the nature of the hunger, right? So Viktor Frankl famously wrote, between stimulus and response, there is a space, and in that space lies our freedom, our liberation, right? Mm-hmm. So I created a forced space where I had to witness the nature of the stimulus, the hunger. And then instead of immediately just reacting, I had to delineate whether or not that hunger was an actual biological need, or was it an emotional and psychological desire? Was it a need or was it a desire? And almost every time it was a desire. I was bored. I was upset. Someone insulted me on Instagram. I needed some form of comfort, et cetera. I needed to eat my feelings, whatever it happened to be. And this ability to delineate between need and desire began to punctuate all these other places of my life. It's a mindset, really, such that like when I have three horrible, adorable daughters, they will do plenty of things to aggravate me. but instead of just immediately reacting and getting mad, I started to be able to find that space and kind of witness the nature of the stimulus and be like, well, why? What would precipitate that kind of behavior? And how do I recognize that feeling? And then what is the appropriate response to that? And of course, like, it can punctuate all parts of your life, from shopping to Instagram to drinking, all of these places that have become sort of subconscious habits that could really benefit from that mindset.
Well, this is, if I think of the language, like my language and the language of the show, this is the mental fitness, right? Like, you're training your mind in those moments. And this is the beautiful thing about this kind of work, is the ripple effect just cascades across everything, right? As you're mentioning, your self-awareness starts to boost and so forth. Then it's the infinite scroll and loop that we want, essentially, in our lives when we're doing these kind of things, because then you're usually more open to other modalities or practices. It's like, okay, well, I'm seeing this. Well, what, maybe I'll try, I'm looking at the list of some of the things in the course, like light therapy or deliberate cold therapy, heat therapy. I mean, you just become more open to experimentation because you're feeling better, right? And you're seeing that evolution and that progression, which is beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, we're so accustomed to downward spirals in health.
Yeah.
Right? But here's the gospel. Here's the good news. Upward spirals are possible too. And they're right there. And that's what I began to experience. And you slowly begin to stack different protocols and behaviors on top of each other. And the body is literally dying to heal.
Yeah.
And to feel that efflorescence in your body, that upward spiral is just a wonderful experience.
I do want to talk about a couple other subjects before I have to let you go, because I mean, and I encourage everyone listening, take a look at the other protocols, and then they're all super important, but there are taught like light therapy and cold and so forth. There's a lot of conversations around these, in the present moment, at least. The two that I really piqued my curiosity was around social fitness, and then also stressful conversations. And I'll provide a description on this one, because it put a smile on my face. I'm like, I've got to ask Jeff about this. Said, how, in brackets, 25 Zoom calls with people that hate me built my psychological immune system and changed my life and brain. Talk to us a little bit more about that one.
Yeah. Hate me might be slightly hyperbolized, but...
Sure.
But certainly didn't agree with me vehemently. So okay. I'll set the table on it. So March 2020, I think we remember that time. It was an anchoring into port lockdown. And my partner, Jake, who you may have met here and there or certainly on email, really pushed me to start this weekly column called Commusing. So it's an essay that I write every Sunday. It has a very significant distribution size.
Yeah, I felt that. You had a nice write-up about the book, actually, on that. So thank you again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, it's north of a million, I think, on there. But in any case, the intention here was to provide little buoys of hope, you know, in a time that was characterized by very stormy seas, and, you know, to share stories such that other people could see their own story in those stories, and to be able to like share emotions and confusion is sometimes helpful and provide some relief. So that was the intention. But very quickly, you know, I was over a literary barrel like every Sunday, and these essays are significant. They're like 1500 to 2000 words. And I really do spend quite a bit of time there. And, you know, they're really meant to be very like rigorous examinations of societal issues or health issues, et cetera. And, you know, somewhat unfortunately for the world, but very fortunate for my column, there was plenty on offer to write about in 2020.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, all of the to's and fro's of the pandemic, but certainly at least in our country, the reckoning around social justice in the wake of the murder of George Floyd, and then, you know, the election and all of the various emanations coming out of, you know, Trumplandia, and, you know, QAnon, the rise of QAnon, and all of this other kind of stuff. So I was trying to kind of take on a lot of topics, you know, often try to find a spiritual bent to them, but often I thought of it very much as kind of the middle way, you know, trying to find some sort of coherence and middle in a world that seemed to be careening towards the thinnest edges of the branch. Anyways, I started to deploy these emails or these essays. I included, for better or worse, my personal email to them. And, you know, over the course of 2,000 words, when you're talking about these topics, you're going to find a way to offend people.
Of course.
And so Monday morning, I would wake up, the bow of my inbox would be crested with some 500, 600 emails. And candidly, most of them were very encouraging and, you know, adulated my ego just enough to write the next one. But I'd probably get two dozen, maybe three dozen a week that were highly critical and disparaging of something that I wrote. And, you know, these were really coming from all parts of society. They were coming from people that were very anti-pharma. They were coming from people that thought I was an anti-vaxxer. There were people that were on the way far left and sort of the abolish the police, social justice warriors. There were people, a lot of people on the very far right, kind of in the MAGA world, all over the place. I was getting, you know, this coming in. And some of it was just, there was nothing to do with it. It was just like Trump 2020, like copied 1,000 times in an email. There's nothing I can do with that. But many of them were quite thoughtful. And, you know, they laid out where they had disagreement with me. And, you know, I would exchange, I vowed to exchange emails with the thoughtful detractors. And I did. And then, you know, over, you know, three or four emails that went back and forth with some of these folks, I would be like, hey, let's have a Zoom call, you know, let's just connect. This is as close as I ever came to being David Copperfield, because this is how I made people disappear generally. But
yeah,
26 people over the course of August and September 2020 took me up on it. And so I spent, you know, Monday and Tuesday afternoons across that period for an hour at a time having Zoom calls with people that didn't agree with me.
Wow.
And by that time, I really had built my psychological immune system. And so what I mean by that, Mark, is you know, by analogy with your physiological immune system, you know, you build your adaptive immune system through exposure, low-grade exposure to pathogens, to bacteria, to viruses, such that your body makes antibodies to those. And then when you come across them, you have a defense mechanism for those and you have the memory to create those. And the same really can be applied, honestly, to your psychological immune system. I had had enough insult hurled my way that, and this is very stoic, really, that I had built kind of a sense of euthymia, to use the Greek word, sort of an unflappable capability that I could emotionally regulate around being criticized or insulted. So that was very, very important going in to these conversations, because I wasn't triggered. I was in a place of open-heartedness and attunement and relatability such that I could create the set and setting of safety and security for these people that were coming mm-hmm. on. And these weren't recorded or anything. So these were private. All that said, I didn't at that juncture have any training in nonviolent communication. I subsequently got a crash course in it. But then, you know, subsequently got schooled a little on Marshall Rosenberg and his whole approach to this kind of communication. But I was going mostly by instinct. And, you know, these conversations very, very quickly took on a very discernible pattern. So I would get on the Zoom, very much like this one, and there would be, you know, some pleasantries exchanged. And somewhat unlike this conversation, I wouldn't say anything for generally 40, 45 minutes.
Oh, and, wow.
And this was the pattern that emerged, was that people just simply gish galloped their life story at me. You know, their broken relationships, their marriages, their kids, their alcohol problems, their social settings, their boarded up main streets, their fentanyl ridden towns. I mean, I heard every story you could imagine, you know.
Wow.
And almost never did the original issue that had put us at loggerheads come up. I mean,
isn't that
maybe
fascinating?
Yeah. So maybe it did at the end of the conversation, but almost never in this opening salvo. And very quickly, I realized that generally people that were angry or expressing some sort of criticism, they really just needed a venue to be seen and to be heard.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
And that was the service that I was providing. I was providing that setting in a safe and secure way for people to be seen and heard. And so that was my first realization into stressful conversations. And then, you know, as I got better at it, as I was listening to people's stories, I would be taking notes, my pencil, and I'd be writing down like places of convergence between my life and theirs. So maybe they were born in Chicago. Maybe they have daughters. Maybe they played tennis. Maybe they drove cross country. Maybe their car broke down too many times. All
yeah,
things
yeah.
that have happened to me. And when they had essentially exhausted themselves, that's what I would focus on. I would yeah. be like, oh, that's so interesting, man. I have daughters too. They're a little bit older. Boy, are you in for it? You know, I got myself a cabin and a shotgun, but whatever, you know. I would just, and my goal very quickly was not to seek agreement or solution, but to seek connection. And it was really an amazing and eye-opening experience. I mean, like I said, sometimes we would then get around to the original issue, but it would be deflated of vitriol. You know,
yeah.
it would be just like, oh, wait, there is some common humanity here. And I built this whole Rolodex. It sits in my phone as frenemies. And like, you know, I have 26 of them, and I've still stayed you know, in touch over text with maybe 10 of them. And again, you know, it's a lot of people, and now we kind of like jibe and rib each other. And these are like, you know, hardcore BLM people on one side and then like super Trumpers on the other side. And they're like sending me like photos of their picnics with Trump banners everywhere. And I'm like, why the hell you got those banners up? And they're like, because this is what we love, baby. Like whatever. And we're just, and it's become, it's just, we somehow see the humanity in each other first.
Yeah.
And then we can get around to the places that we might have some disagreement. And I guess I would just say that this training in having thorny, difficult, stressful conversations was so important, because if you can do that with people that you don't even know, just think about how useful that skill is in your life with the people that you care about so much.
Yeah.
And we tend to avoid these conversations, you know, with our parents, with our friends, with our partners, with our loved ones, with our kids. And there is a way to have stressful conversations that yields the same kind of benefit as when you stress a bicep, you know, your relationships can grow.
Good stress. Mm-hmm. Good stress. I mean, there are just two things really quick that come to mind listening to that story. Is one is just, I think it exposes globally how much we're hurting, you know, because if I hear, you know, based on what you said that was coming up, it's just, to me, I just hear there's a lot of people, and, you know, myself included, there's no shortage of healing. I think that has to take place. And, but if we can have the self-awareness individually as well, that, yeah, there's, you know, I've got stuff as well too, and not take that next immediate step and avoid that, you know, the short-circuiting pause to take another course of action, realizing, hey, I'm probably reacting in this moment versus responding, or to your point, just being open and being human. There's some benefit there. Then kind of the second thing is, and I'm sure you've interviewed Jerry before, Jerry Colonna, in the past.
I haven't. I know that he was in your book, and I know that you've interviewed him, and he's a remarkable human. Yeah.
You guys definitely need to connect, because Jerry's latest work, and he's been on for this one recently as well, is just talking about all the division around the world, and basically the long story short, that if you really start to ask questions and you really start to understand where you've come from, and you were doing this with bringing in, you know, your daughters and so forth, we're actually, it's like his line is, your story is my story. We're actually not that different. And then, you know, when you can have conversations from that perspective, all of a sudden it diffuses it to being a little bit more middle ground versus these extremes, right?
Yeah.
Which is just, it's fascinating. It's fascinating stuff.
Yeah. And again, you know, apply that same question, you know, how did we evolve? Well, we didn't evolve without conflict. We had plenty of conflict.
Yeah.
But how did we actually have to manage and deal with that conflict to find common ground and cooperation? We had to do it just like this, in face to face, in real time, not, you know, anonymously behind, you know, a keyboard as some digital warrior. You know, we had to talk and work through our differences. And it really does yield great results. I mean, I really feel like every great achievement of humanity has been predicated on that ability to cooperate, you know, flexibly and at scale. Oftentimes, everything that we've built, you know, requires that sense of that my own individual rights and freedoms are actually one and the same with the collective. And, you know, and that we need to self-impose that kind of stressful conversation in an era where we don't really have to have them. It's like we can just sit at home on X, but that's not really having them. You know, it's not happening.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, I I suspected this was going to happen. I knew I'd get to the end of this and feel like, well, we probably have a good 2 hours to go in us on any of these topics. So we'll have to do another round at one point. But in the meantime, once again, Jeff, want to thank you for taking time to come on the show again, but then also just, you know, always following your own curiosity and letting what needs to surface, because, you know, I see this in this course on good stress. I mean, obviously this came out of a personal situation, but there's just so much benefit and good in the protocols and in the work and what you're trying to put out there, that the ripple effect of this is exponential across so many different topics and people. So thank you for continuing to follow the language of curiosity and ask great questions. And I'm excited to see, you know, where the next round of questions go. So thank you. And I'll leave it to you. Any final words for the listeners?
Yeah. Well, Mark, it's always such a treat to connect with you. I hope we can connect in four-dimensional space-time soon. I really appreciate the opportunity to connect with you and your community. I would just say kind of simply, like, we have to become comfortable with a certain amount of discomfort. Mm-hmm. You know, in my life, and I'm sure other people can relate to this, that, you know, our greatest challenges have almost always become our greatest teachings, and that, you know, doing hard things makes doing other hard things easier. And, you know, we can deliberately self-impose the doing of hard things. And in my life, I've found that to have incredible results and impacts.
Well said, brother. Well said. And until next time.